I'm particularly delighted that we were able to find space in our programme of meetings to hold tonight's discussion on the future of the UK pension system. It is a matter of national importance and impinges on many of the areas which actuaries work in. After the recent general election, David Blunkett was appointed as Secretary of State for Work and Pensions, which I think indicates the importance which the government attaches to these issues. He's already made it clear that he intends to press ahead with reforms to the UK pension system. The Pensions Commission under Adair Turner will report in the autumn. This will represent a huge opportunity coming early in a new parliament for difficult decisions to be taken. The next few months could see the shape of the UK pension system being set for the next generation. Now, I don't intend to give a long introduction. After all, I had my say in this hall last September. But I can't resist one or two scene-setting comments. Firstly, it is not the role of the actuarial profession to be party political, although individual members can be and often are. Our role is to spell out the implications of different policy proposals, and we should not be afraid to let our voice be heard. The starting point for any consideration of pension reform has to be the demographic changes happening here, as in most other developing countries. We have increasing longevity, a falling birth rate, plus a baby boom generation about to retire. In short, a rapidly ageing population. Now, we could muddle through on the pensions front, as Adair Turner has explained. Individuals would probably adapt their behaviour, working longer, saving more, but probably only in the last few years of work as the harsh realities struck home, and overall settling for a poorer retirement than they'd hoped. Now, what would be the social implications of this muddling through approach? Each generation expects to be better off than the previous one as a result of economic growth. If this doesn't happen, they are likely to be bitter and resentful, and they're a powerful voting group. But the current generation of younger retired have been described as a golden generation. Millions are enjoying or will shortly enjoy generous final salary occupational pensions, especially those in the public sector. SERPs has waxed and waned, but the biggest winners are those who reach state pension age around 1998. And many workers have retired in their 50s, not always from choice, but on enhanced pension terms. The problem I see flowing from the ageing population is that it will be very much harder for the next generation to be significantly better off in retirement than the current one. Inevitably, the average age at which people retire will creep up, particularly as early retirement before 60 or even 65 becomes a thing of the past. The advent of DC schemes will encourage and accelerate this trend. It's often said that we need to encourage higher savings for retirement, but there are no simple solutions to this problem. There are so many factors to take into account. For instance, personal debt is immense and continuing to grow. There are alternative ways of saving. Just think of owner-managed small businesses. Investing in the business with a view to selling it on when you no longer want to work is a genuine form of retirement saving. And what will be the impact of inheritance as the new generation of house owners pass on their assets, just as their children are themselves reaching retirement age? Equity REIS has, I am convinced, an important role to play as part of the overall solution to retirement income. The profession is doing good work in this field and has published two reports in recent years with further ongoing work. Work-based pensions will, I believe, be a key component of any solution. There is survey evidence that people trust their employer more than anyone else when it comes to dealing with financial services. Occupational schemes are also more cost-effective than individual pensions. There are new risk-sharing designs spanning the spectrum between final salary and pure DC, which point the way forward. On the choice between greater compulsion or increased encouragement for voluntary savings, I believe there's a major need for the proponents of a compulsory system to spell out just how it might operate. Our role as actuaries will be to point out the implications. For instance, would there be strong pressure from the public for guaranteed outcomes to their compulsory savings? And would that then lead to risk-free or minimum risk investment strategies? And if so, Why is that better than expanding the state pay-as-you-go system? Finally, there are challenges for actuaries in the product design area. How do we provide low-cost products in a low-interest rate environment? And I believe the time is ripe for a radical rethink on annuities. They are much maligned in the media, but provide an important protection against outliving your resources in old age. I would suggest they are no longer suitable for 50 and 60-year-olds. They could do their job much better if they were not bought until, say, 75 or 80 even. That would leave the way open for savings institutions to design new products for people during their 60s and 70s. Well, that's enough from me. The problems are challenging and multifaceted. The solutions are likely to be highly contentious, as we are beginning to see from this weekend's press, and they will be multifaceted too. I look forward very much to this evening's discussion. And to get it off to a start, I'm very pleased to welcome Alison O'Connell, Director of the Pensions Policy Institute, which is doing much good work in analysing these issues and publishing the results. Alison.
Thank you very much, Michael. And it's great to be back at the Institute among friends, I hope. As Michael indicated, there's an amazing interest in pension reform. And in the last 3.5 years or so, as the Pension Policy Institute has been operating, it's been quite striking to me how at the start we may have thought that pension reform was some time off. We just had some major reforms after all. Now it seems almost a certainty that there'll be some more major reforms, if not in this Parliament, then in the next. And of course, it's a vast subject, as the reading list suggested for this evening just indicates. Now, I could do the traditional thing for a sessional meeting and reprise all of the reading that was suggested for this meeting, but you may be relieved to hear that I'm not going to do that. Instead, I'm going to take the privilege of picking out what I think are the most important bits. So I apologise in advance if I've missed out your favourite bit, but I hope you'll contribute to the discussion. So I'm going to set the scene with why we are talking again about pension reform and then talk about how to resolve it. Not a blueprint for reform, but how to think about the resolution. So to start with, there are a number of concerns in UK pensions. And here are just 5 of them in no particular order. Firstly, just the complexity of the system. The basic state pension, state second pension, guarantee credit, savings credit, and contracting out. 5 different state products, each with their own different rules. And that's before you get to the complexity of occupational and personal pensions. It's complex enough that even though individuals might have trouble understanding it, pension experts can't possibly be expected to know all the elements of the system, which makes even talking about pension reform very difficult. Secondly, we have the simple inadequacy of the state pension system. There is pensioner poverty, much less than when the government came to power in 97 and did do the pensions credit. But there is still some remaining pensioner poverty, more than a lot of people feel comfortable with. That's because, of course, the basic state pension is so low. It's because it doesn't operate well for all groups of people. And because we are increasingly reliant on means-tested benefits, it's important that there is a good take-up of those benefits. The take-up of guarantee credit is now around 80%. The take-up of savings credit, where that's just claimed as a single benefit, is less than 50%, which means that there are a lot of people who are not getting the benefit that they're entitled to. Thirdly, there are inequalities in the system. Now, of course, there are inequalities in income, and therefore you would expect to see inequalities in income in retirement, because occupational and personal pensions have to kind of replicate that. They can't redistribute. But the problem we have is that the state pension system also has inequalities in it. So it kind of leverages up the disadvantage for certain groups of people. Particular people that are, of course, talked about usually for being disadvantaged are females and the oldest pensioners. Now, for women, 50% of women are not entitled to a full basic state pension in their own right. And even going 20 years further out, the average woman will have a basic state pension 15% less than the average man. And these figures are important because it's a big problem today, but also it's not a problem that's going to go away by just letting the system pan out. And the oldest pensioners are particularly hard hit, not just because there's a kind of cohort effect, but because also the indexation of the basic state pension. That's not the only extent of disadvantage in our system. We also have the disabled, the self-employed, other groups, which may actually add up to be more than 50% of our population, are disadvantaged in some way. And one thing I keep having to remind our chairman about at the PPI is that there are more women than men. They are not a minority interest group. The fourth problem is the unsustainability of the pension system. And that really pans out in two different ways, which I'd like to talk about. It's quite straightforward to project out what the cost of the current state pension system will be just by rolling forward the parameters of the system as they will pan out in future. And what that gives you is a fairly level percentage of GDP over the next 50 years for the cost of the state pension. But that has to make some assumptions as to how much people are saving and what the return on those savings will be. So how much pension credit people will be eligible for, and then you need an assumption for how much will be taken up. If you make plausibly different assumptions on those, and some might argue they're more realistic assumptions than the government makes, then you come to a very high, much higher cost of the state pension system in future. In other words, the upside, the risk is all on the upside. But secondly, if you think about a flat spend on state pensions going forward for 50 years, while the number of people over state pension age increases by 50%, that means, of course, you're all actuaries, I don't need to tell you this, that on average people will get less. And can you imagine that a growing proportion of the electorate will be happy for that? So the political pressure is all for state pensions to increase and the cost of state pensions to go up. So I think for those and other reasons, the current framework for state pensions is not sustainable, and we have to think sooner or later about some kind of reform. And now I come to the fifth point, the one about private pensions not filling the gap created by declining state pension and the gap created because we need to put more money in as we all live longer. Now, this is the one that is normally talked about in the pensions debate, about the retirement savings crisis. And the point about this particular slide is that it's one of many problems, and yet it's the one that gets the most airtime. So what I'd like to do is spend a little bit more time on this one and explain what is the nature and the size of the retirement savings gap. And I'm going to do that with reference to the Pensions Commission numbers, the estimates that they put forward. What they said was that the gap can be defined by what we need to fill in order to maintain the living standards of pensioners through to 2050 on average. And what that means is that by 2050 we should be transferring 14% nearly of GDP to people over state pension age. Now, by the numbers that I talked about earlier, the state pension, the bottom bit of this bar, will give us 6.9% of GDP, although, as I said, there might be reasons why that would go up anyway by the time we reach 2050. Now, you have to make some more assumptions as to what the transfer from private pensions might be expected to be by that time. And the assumptions that the Pensions Commission made for their central estimate were these. Firstly, that there would be a fall in pension contributions made to occupational and personal plans, particularly a fall from the current level in occupational pensions, because looking at the numbers we see today, a lot of the money going into pensions are not actually going towards paying for accrued pensions for today's employees. It's making up for the pension contribution holidays in the past. So the central estimate of the Pensions Commission is that there is a fall in pensions contributions of around a third over the next 15 years, and you'll have your own views as to whether or not that's optimistic or pessimistic or realistic, and there are other numbers they did to do your own sensitivity testing. But they also assumed for this estimate was that there was no increase in non-pension saving. In other words, some of the things that Mike was talking about, equity release, just other savings like ISAs and so on, just don't go up anymore to compensate for what they expect to fall in pension savings. Again, you'll come to your own opinion as to whether or not that's realistic. But what it means is that the transfer to pensioners that comes from private pensions in 50 years' time is actually private pensions under the saving. It's actually not much different than it is at the moment, around 4 percentage points of GDP, which means there is a gap of around 3 percentage points of GDP that needs to be filled somehow. Now, one way that could be filled is by people working longer. And again, what the Pensions Commission assumed in their central assumption is that the average retirement age of women goes up as a consequence of the state pension age for women going up from 60 to 65, but it only goes up as far as the current average for men, that's 63.8, and that there's no further increase in either the male or the female average retirement age from that. And again, you'll come to your own views as to whether or not that's realistic. But it's not really a retirement savings gap. It is a gap that potentially might be caused if state pensions, pension saving, non-pension saving, and working later work out in such a way as this. And it might be that things work out differently and the gap is closed. And obviously what the Pensions Commission was set up to do was look at savings ways of closing that gap. Now, with these kind of numbers, as I said, you can do different scenarios. And the ones we've been working on suggest that there are a number of ways to fill the gap. And, of course, the answer is going to be some combination of all these features. But to fill the gap, if state pensions were not improved from the bit on the bottom in the previous slide, then we really do need to be considering both saving more and working longer. And, of course, there's a kind of complicated second-order thing going on here, which is that if people do save more, they might be tempted to retire earlier. So you have to bear that in mind. But with better state pensions, then it begins to be more feasible around either working longer or saving more, becoming more possible to fill that gap, or some more feasible, smaller increase in both saving and working longer. The point I'm trying to make is, of course, that saving is very important, but it's not just an issue about saving. And really, in order to consider what the right way forward is for pensions, we have to start with the thing that everybody pays for and everybody benefits from, the state pension system. Because you have to understand how much there's going to come from the basic state pension in 50 years' time, so that you have that firm underpin for whatever scenarios you want to look at from the other things, the savings and the working longer. So we think reform to a better first-tier state pension has to come first. And the important thing about that is that when you're reforming the state pension system, you do it not just because you've identified the savings gap as being an issue, but because you've identified those five issues on my first slide, the inequalities, the complexity, the inadequacies, the unsustainability, and you want to solve all those problems, not just the savings one. So the state pension is very important, and there are lots of good reasons why it needs to be changed. State pensions are very important to everyone, but they are particularly important to the majority of people. And the fact that really speaks very clearly to that is if you look at how the working age population of this country is distributed according to earnings. What this slide shows is the number of people of working age by income group. So the first bar shows the over 9 million people who are not working. Now, most of those are coloured in purple, because they are not accruing a private pension. There is no money going in from either them or an employer into an occupational or personal scheme. A few of them there is, must be some kind of stakeholder thing, but mostly they're not getting any other pension. And they will most likely be very dependent, if not totally, on the state pension. The next bar is the nearly 7 million people who are earning less than £10,000 a year. And again, the majority of those are accruing no personal pension, private pension at all. The next bar is where there are most people, of course, around the 10 to 20,000 earnings mark. And they are sort of 50-50, having an occupational personal pension or not. And it's only when you get beyond that in earnings terms where you get the majority of people actually accruing a private pension. And I know as actuaries that you are on the right-hand side of this distribution. And it's quite telling, I think, just how few people there are on that scale. And especially when one thinks that pension policy is usually made by people on that side of the scale, it's really telling that you can't let personal circumstances or personal experience stand in the way of some good facts when it comes to thinking about pension policy reform. But the real point of the slide is that if you add up all the purples, you find that 20 million people are not accruing some kind of private pension, and 15 million are out of the 35 million working age people. And that says that although some of these people will have a private pension in later years and all the rest of it, it's quite likely to be quite small. And therefore, for most people, the state pension will be, if not of total relevance, of great significance in their retirement income. So again, another argument for looking at state pensions first. Now, I'm probably preaching to the converted here, because a number of organisations have already said that state pension reform needs to happen and have made proposals for what state pension reform should be. In fact, if you go through some of the submissions made in response to the Pensions Commission first report, it's quite telling that while the Commission was set up to look at long-term savings, all the submissions talk about reform of the state first tier. So that really is where the kind of the gravity, the centre of gravity is amongst pension reform at the moment. And there's been a lot of talk in the press about whether or not there's consensus or not consensus about what that reform actually should be. But I think we can discern some form of consensus. The Pensions Policy Institute did an analysis of the kind of 30 major organisations making submissions to the Pensions Commission and other policy proposals that have been made. Of those, nearly all want the state pension, we're talking about the first tier of state foundation pension, to be indexed to earnings. So that is a reversal of the linkage to prices that happened some years ago now, and really is why the basic state pension is so low. Again, nearly all organisations want that basic tier to be at least at the level of the guarantee credit, the means-tested income of £109 a week. So I think what that says is that there is a definite consensus among pensions organisations that the role of the state should be to deliver a basic tier of state pension that will avoid poverty in the population, not just alleviate it for some people, but guarantee an avoidance of poverty. Now, how that pension is designed, there's less consensus, but there's also less knowledge and less consideration. So while 14 organisations out of our sample of 30 would say that they would propose that pension to be on a citizenship or universal basis, 5 would say keep the contributory principle, and the remainder just don't know or suggest it should be renewed. And again, half of that sample would say that the state second pension should be scrapped in the interests of simplicity, so that that first tier of basic pension is the only one and it can be made as high as possible, and then everything is simplified for occupational and personal saving on top. Other organisations want to keep some kind of state second tier, even if they also want the first tier improved. Now, how do we make sense of these kind of these wishes? Well, we have to think about how much they will cost. And one thing that is particularly noticeable about a lot of the proposals that are made is that the organisations making them just don't have the available information to work out how they would cost. So they are, to some extent, wish lists. They are, to some extent, well, it would be nice to have. But now the debate really needs to start about what we can practically afford to have. And I'd like to take you through some examples of that so you can begin to see the kind of trade-offs that we will obviously now have to make in terms of how much we're prepared to pay for better state pensions, either through taxes or through other means like raising the state pension age. So everybody wants some kind of better state first tier. How are we going to pay for that? How much will it cost? Well, a better first tier will cost more. What this slide shows over the next 50 years is firstly the solid purple line, the one that runs level. That's the projection of how much the current system will cost on the government estimate if we just roll forward the current system for the next 50 years. And you can see, as I said earlier, that's level, even though there are all these increasing number of pensioners. The dotted line you see is our estimate of what the upside risk might be on that cost, on some fairly plausible assumptions for people not saving as much as the government hopes they will do, and therefore falling back onto pension credit more than the government is assuming they will. So there's a fairly big funnel of doubt for what the current system might cost. And in the middle of that funnel of doubt fits quite nicely the policy option that we were asked to cost for the NAPF, the citizens' pension, at £109 a week. Now, I could have put other lines on there for other models, but they're not published yet. And I think that's where we need to take the debate as to what other models will look like. But even if you said a basic state pension on the contributory system at £109 a week, it's going to look very similar to that cost in the long term, although the short term would be more expensive. The short term cost of the citizen pension is actually below the current system because of the way in which you can transition, and I would recommend the NAPF publication to give you the details on that. But without worrying too much about the details, what I think this slide illustrates is that in order to get a better state pension that is along the lines of what most organisations want, will be plus or minus quite a bit more expensive than what the government expects to pay in 50 years' time. About 2 percentage points of GDP more. And there are no money trees at the bottom of the garden, so that money will have to come from somewhere. And if it isn't from an increase in taxes, where is it going to come from? Well, 2 percentage points of GDP is 20% of the budget for health services and 40% of the budget for education. So it's not easy to switch from one pot to another. We can't. It's going to have to come from either raising taxes or reducing or increasing the state pension age. Now, how much difference would that make? The next slide is going to keep the cost of the current system and the possible upside cost, the dotted line. And the pink line is magically going to be the same proposal for a citizen's pension at 109, but if you increase the state pension age to 70. And it runs along the cost of the current system, which would be nice, but I think, politically speaking, an increase to a state pension age of 70, even by 2030, which is what this assumes, is going to be very difficult to achieve. So we would still be looking at some combination of state pension age going up and increased taxes. But the other line on this graph shows basically the same proposal in the long term, keeping the basic state pension at the higher level, £109 a week. But also retaining the state second pension, keeping a second tier in the system. And that costs yet another 1 percentage point or so of GDP. So to improve the state pension, not only in the first tier, but also in the second tier, will obviously cost a great deal of money, and we have to figure out where we're going to get that from. Now, if you want to have a better first tier along the lines that I've shown here, and then have compulsion on top, by which I mean compulsion into some kind of private savings, then that will cost extra money as well. But instead of the extra cost, the extra 1% of GDP going on taxes and being redistributed by the state, it will need to go into your own savings pot. So that extra money has to be found on top of some kind of extra taxes for a better state pension as well. And when you start to think about that, it's clear that there are some real trade-offs we have to make about how good we want the pension to be from the state, how much we're prepared to save for it, and how much we want additional earnings-related pensions on top. And to show that conceptually, I think what this chart tries to do is to crystallise the real, the point at which the debate has now reached, I think. What this shows along the x-axis, the horizontal axis, I can say that because I'm in an actuarial audience, is, again, people arranged according to their incomes and taking it cumulatively, so you can see where half the population falls. The horizontal line is what the state would deliver through a better state pension of the first tier. And I've put that at 22% of national average earnings, which is the guarantee credit level. But obviously the choice is whereabout you put that line. We know that if you put it where the solid line is, that's at the £109 a week. That's going to cost around 8% of GDP. Now, if you want an earnings-related tier on top of that, and it could look like that pink one, or it could have some other shape, but broadly going up in line with earnings, that is going to cost even more. Whether it's into a state earnings-related scheme, we resurrect something like SERPs, or whether it's into compulsory private savings, which individuals might own, but they still have to find the money somewhere if it's compulsory. And the question is that if we look at where most people are, which is at where I've put the circle, where the people that we're most worried about because they're at risk of low pensions incomes, and simply most people are in that kind of income bracket, it's a real finely balanced trade-off question for them as to whether or not they would actually prefer a higher state pension, where redistribution could put more money into their pocket through the state, or whether or not they would prefer an earnings-related system where they might get less money out of it, but higher-income people might get more. And I think that's the real kind of difficult question that is now beginning to be thought about in the pensions debate. But we need more numbers around that. We need much more modelling work to understand the costs and the way these different proposals impact on people of different income situations. So I'd like to finish with what I think are the key questions that need to be answered in this debate. A lot of what we're hearing from the press and so on is like this big pensions problem. And we need a way of chunking down the issues and thinking about them in some kind of sensible order. And this is what I think is the right list of questions. Firstly, what first tier pension should the state deliver? Should the state actually deliver through its mechanism so it can redistribute and pay for through taxes on national insurance contributions? At what level should that pension be? And then how should it be delivered? Through the existing contributory system or through some kind of citizenship or universal pension that uses a residency test instead? Once we have that, then we're in a better position to answer the next questions. I think the second question should be, what second tier, and that will be an earnings-related tier pension, should the state compel? None at all. In other words, the role of the state once the first tier is delivered should not be in delivery or compulsion, perhaps enabling, but the state should basically not do very much in the kind of earnings-related tier. Should it be delivered by the state, or should it be delivered by the private sector through occupational personal pensions, in which case the state will still intervene in order to sort of mandate how that happens? And if there were to be that kind of compulsion, should it be just on the employer or on both the employer and the employee? And then having got the kind of a first tier and perhaps a second tier of what the state says really must happen, we can think about the things that the state should enable, should help to happen, but not necessarily say must happen. In other words, the state has a policy role through having an objective, but the state doesn't necessarily have a role in delivering or mandating. And that includes things like incentives, where the state actually puts some money towards incentives for pensions or other saving like ISAs, or whether the state puts down rules for how things should operate, for example, automatic enrolment into occupational pension schemes. Or should the state just help some things around giving education and the informed choice type of programmes that are currently being developed? Somewhere around there is the fourth question around should there be an option to switch from state to private, or should basically contracting out be abolished because it's a switch of money without necessarily creating new money, and it just makes the whole thing more complicated. Now, all of that is around state pensions and savings, and the state also has a role in some kind of encouragement of working later. But the real question is, how much can the state do in that? And what more can it do on top of the kind of age discrimination legislation that we're going to see in operation soon? Should the state's efforts be focused on changing employer behaviour, or should the state's efforts be focused more on trying to change individual behaviour? And, of course, we immediately think of what the role state pension age has in all of that. So there are some very meaty questions, and as I indicated, I think that we're only partway through understanding some of the trade-offs that need to be made in that. But I hope that's helpful in terms of trying to put a sensible order as to how these questions can be attacked. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alison. The discussion is now open to the floor, and it would help me just to work out how many speakers are likely to want to speak. Could you just raise your hand if you're... Right, thank you very much. Okay. I'd like, if possible, to make this a slightly more informal meeting than our normal sessional meeting. So if there's anybody who hasn't planned to speak but feels moved later on to come and join in the discussion, then please feel welcome. Don't be put off by the fact that we record the meeting and there is a transcript published afterwards. You will get a chance to edit your remarks before they appear in the written record. So we've also got some roving microphones, if people would prefer to use those rather than coming up to the lectern. And could I ask you to state your name clearly before you speak? Now, there is one speaker who's asked to show some slides as part of his speech, so we thought we would take that first while we've got the... while we've got the computer on. So if Ronnie Sloan would like to come forward. Ronnie. And after Ronnie, I'll call Colin Stewart.
Thank you, Michael. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. There are countless interlocking pieces in the overall pensions jigsaw, many of which will be touched on tonight, but I propose to focus on only one issue. As prompted by Michael in his opening remarks, compulsory pension saving, which I feel needs to be explored in much more detail before the many strongly held views on this subject become even more polarised than they already are. My purpose is not to make out a case for compulsion, not a proponent, as Michael invited, although I feel that some form of compulsion is probably inevitable, but rather to put forward for discussion a blueprint, my very word, for an acceptable method of what I think the press would term semi-soft compulsion. So I'll first examine the effective pension value conferred by employers on members of existing public sector pension schemes. Here we have the NHS and local government as examples of final salary schemes. And you'll see the broad pattern of value being conferred. That's net of employee contributions at 6%. And you can then add in the civil service scheme, which is the same as column 2, but with a 3% differential in the members' contributions. The key point is that the value is clearly age-related, as is, of course, obvious to us as actuaries, but which is also being recognised elsewhere in tangible ways. Now, one example is under the civil service scheme, which now offers a money purchase alternative on the age-related scale shown here at the right. So given the fundamental logic of age-increasing money purchase contributions, I set out here my proposed scale of compulsory contributions applied to pay only between LEL and UEL and payable by employers only, not by employees. So no question of being regarded as a pension tax. And a nice simple formula, in case you haven't noticed it, of age divided by 10 in 5-year bands. 30-year-old pays 3%, gets chief presenter, sorry. And on top of this compulsory core, I propose a further layer of optional matching, where employee contributions up to the level of the core would be matched pound for pound by employers up to the same level again as the core scale. So at its maximum shown here, this could result in total contributions of 3 times the core scale, with the employer-employee split being 2-1. Now, before we consider some other related issues, I will next look at the possible pensions that could be generated by such a scale of tiered contributions. And here I show on realistic funding assumptions, that's them at the left there, the projected pensions at age 65 resulting from the maximum fully matched scale, which will be seen gives rise to a pension accrual rate of very close to 1.25%. Oops, they've disappeared. The answer is at the bottom. There's always some wizardry goes wrong with slides. Anyway, the accrual rate in each of the boxes there is very close to 1.25%, and which I summarise at the bottom. But I assure you that the answer works out at that level pretty uniformly. If I then, let's see what happens with this law. Ah, they're correct. That's the one-third level of that at the core contributions only, the non-contributory core. And here we see that the answer is a third of that, or 240ths of salary minus LEL. And, of course, the overall outcome will lie somewhere in between 240ths and 80ths, depending on each individual employee's chosen optional level of saving. If I can now turn to some anti-compulsion arguments, I believe that unaffordability and other family priorities are addressed by the compulsory core scale being employer only, and with the optional matching being tiered by age, such that higher contributions may be paid at times in people's career when likely to be more affordable. And remember, the pension accrual secured is uniform at all ages. Now, cost to the employer is, of course, an important issue, and the specimen workforce shown here leads to a compulsory core contributions costing just over 3.5% of total payroll, perhaps not too huge a burden. Now, if maximum employee matching were to occur throughout, which is most unlikely, then this would evidently double the potential cost to a maximum of about 7% of payroll. Now, as the actual figure would depend on the age distribution of each workforce, I would propose a maximum of, say, 6% of payroll to avoid age discrimination, any excess above this being offset against the employer's total national insurance bill. And there would also be provision for total exemption from this tiered compulsion where alternative schemes met a prescribed requisite contribution or value test. Now, to those who might balk at even a 6% employer maximum, I would remind you that the well-regarded Australian system of compulsory contributions now amounts to 9% of eligible pay, having started at 3% back in 1992. Moreover, experience there has shown that introduction of compulsory employer contributions has in fact encouraged increasing amounts of voluntary member contributions, which I would expect to be mirrored in the UK too. And I would also introduce an incentive for the lower paid by changing employee pension contribution tax relief to a simple flat rate basis of perhaps 25% across the board. Well, that is a one-third add-on to what the employee pays. In other words, each £75 paid in would become £100 invested. Now, if that tax relief suggestion is a simplification and one that should help to balance the Treasury's books, even allowing for the hope for growth in pension savings, I know that many will argue that such tiered contributions are just too complicated. Well, having over the last 25 years personally implemented countless such tiered money purchase plans, I can honestly say that I have never encountered any difficulties in members being able to understand them, or perhaps after a little bit of explanation. Which brings me to my final point. So here I remind you of the maximum fully matched scale under my proposal, against which we compare the civil service money purchase option that I mentioned earlier, here including the employees' 3% that was part of the matching deal, and now the second pillar compulsory scale introduced in Switzerland back in 1985, some 20 years ago now. Quite similar, it so happens. So if tiered contributions can work for the financially astute Swiss and for our own civil service, then I commend such a structure as a blueprint against which to consider the possible adoption of compulsory pension savings in the UK. Thank you.
Colin Stewart, and then Stuart Nine.
Mr. President, my name is Colin Stewart. I must try not to be stimulated by the two previous speakers because I'm going to concentrate on a fairly narrow point, which neither of them covered, but I think is a pressing problem today. That is the need to remove the burden of buyout on wind-up from the existing defined benefit schemes. This may be possible if a scheme can still be confident of getting a higher rate of return on its investments than the rate assumed in the calculation of non-profit deferred annuities. Some years ago, when the government's plans for an MFR were being discussed, I did warn that in the buyout provision in scheme rules, we already had a minimum funding requirement, and it would therefore be folly to introduce a lower MFR without overriding that provision. But, as sometimes happens, the government ignored my advice. It listened instead to the siren voices saying that what might happen on wind-up could safely be ignored. The siren voices have a lot to answer for. I suppose it's now too late to override buyout, but we may be able to persuade members to agree to give it up. In the present climate, it should be possible for a company to convince its employees that drastic measures are required. This is what I suggest. Offer existing members a bigger wind-up benefit, perhaps LPI plus 1% in the period to pension age, if they agree to give up the right to buy out. The cash equivalent of the bigger benefit should enable the member to secure at least as big a benefit at retirement, since the cash could be invested in something better than a non-profit deferred annuity. If they accepted this offer, they would continue to accrue salary-related benefits in the present scheme. A money purchase scheme would be set up for new employees and for the future service of any existing employees who decided not to accept the changed wind-up benefits. Existing employees would appreciate that the company's business was suffering as a result of the deficiency to close its pension fund, and see the need to eliminate buyout, but this might not influence former employees with deferred pensions. They could be offered the same increase, but it might prove necessary to offer them an extra incentive, such as an increase in the benefit promised on retirement. Mr. President, if there is to be any future for defined benefits and pension schemes, the benefit promise must be confined to the benefits paid on retirement. The benefit paid on withdrawal or wind-up will have to be a realistic value of the pension benefits accrued to date, reflecting an appropriate investment policy. But we may be too late. Even with guaranteed benefits available only on retirement, the risks may still be too great for companies to accept, in which case personal pensions will become the norm in the private sector, and apparently in the public sector as well. One advantage of a system of personal pensions is that an individual who wished to retire early could draw down on the balance until the state pension became payable. So it would be compatible with an increase in the state pension to age 70, which becomes more and more inevitable. The remaining question is whether the government is willing to increase the state pension to a level which would keep most pensioners off means-tested benefits. If they do this, they can take a more relaxed view of occupational pensions. If they don't, then I expect personal pensions will have to be compulsory, with minimum contributions specified for the individual and the employer.
The Stuart Lyon and then Leslie Tutt.
President, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Stuart Lyon. I spent most of my professional career deeply involved in pensions and found myself on various committees and working parties concerned with the interrelationship between state and occupational pensions. My presidential address in this hall in 1982 was on that subject. For the past 18 years, I've been drawing a pension related to final salary, though, as has been indicated earlier, my children and grandchildren seem unlikely to be as fortunate. Times and attitudes have changed. You may think that an enduring partnership between the state and the occupational sector to produce an earnings-related pension was always a mirage, and that the many of us who worked to achieve it were wasting our time. But were we? What went wrong, and could we have foreseen it? Well, to start with, any cost that falls on the Exchequer is a cause for concern to the Chancellor of the day, especially if it's increasing, no matter that the increase may have been planned or predicted. Action may be taken to contain the growth, as happened in the examples we've seen earlier when the basic state pension became linked to prices instead of earnings, and again when the formula for the state earnings-related pension was cut back. Now, I'm not arguing that those actions had no reason, for economic and demographic circumstances change and changes influence policy, but the effect was to damage the basis of the partnership. The developments that directly involved occupational schemes were more profound. If we're honest, I think we can see that it was a mistake to use the introduction of SERPs as a lever for extending final salary schemes right across the board. The losses incurred in such schemes by early leavers relative to long stayers were well understood, and in an increasingly volatile labour market, a fairer framework with fewer funding problems would have involved accruing pensions as a percentage of current earnings and revaluing the accrued benefits progressively for price inflation, rather like SERPs does. Then more recently, the funding process has been found wanting. Although a greater than expected improvement in longevity is a significant factor, the root cause, I feel, has been a Treasury requirement to judge under or over funding by reference to assets at market value. While for solvency purposes it may be imprudent in a depressed equity market to take assets above market value, it does not follow that it is prudent to give full credence to current market values when the market is booming. To do so encourages the continuing purchase of equities, and with the cyclical nature of the market, ensures that what appears to be a high surplus will sooner or later turn into a discontinuance deficiency, the more so if the reaction to the surplus is to take a contribution holiday or be forced to do so. The result of recent experience, as we all know, has been the disintegration of the final salary concept and disillusionment with financial institutions and, to a considerable extent, the actuarial profession itself. It's not been helped by the Thatcher government's decision to abolish compulsory membership of occupational schemes and the mis-selling of personal pensions that followed. So here we are, almost back at square one, debating how to move forward again. It's axiomatic, as Alison has explained, that there are two potential sources of retirement income, an unfunded benefit from the state and an income from one or more forms of saving. Most people, as we've seen, need both. And savings are most efficiently generated by contributions deducted from pay or linked to it. To my mind, this is the key to any comprehensive amelioration of the pensions problem. Suppose that the present state second pension scheme was to be replaced by a defined contributions plan based on earnings between minimum and maximum percentages of the national average. If the contributions could not be paid into a suitable occupational scheme, Would it not make sense for the employer to hand them over to a central agency, which could be instructed by individual contributors to pass them on to approved savings media of their own choosing? Unless or until that happened, the agency would hold and accumulate them on the contributors' behalf. Such an arrangement would give employees considerable freedom and flexibility of choice without involving employers in administration for which many are ill-equipped. It would also facilitate continuity on change of employment. I forbear from offering an opinion about selective retirement ages, compulsory annuities, dependence benefits, equity release, how to deal with self-employment, who should bear the investment risk, and other aspects of the present debate. All I will say is that decisions are more likely to endure if they are simple and readily understood. On these counts, the present partnership may be seen to have failed.
Leslie Tutton and then Stephen Yeo.
Mr. President, my name is Tut. In the thesis I wrote in 1981, I reasoned that the state pension age should be increased gradually to an age in the late 60s for both sexes. That suggestion may still seem to have merit, although a number of changing circumstances impinge. Indeed, in fairness to the elderly, instead of the state pension age being raised to assist in reducing rising costs, should the proportion of the national income desirably to be devoted to them be increased? Perhaps there may be justification for many in the population to think so. And as I understood the remarks of the opener, such is very practicable. The notice for this evening's meeting reads, should state pension age be raised? If so, when and by how much? There is no reference to the possible lowering of state pension age. May I thus just mention that in the government report, Command 8173, published in 1981, the year of my own thesis to which I have referred, it is stated that a common state pension age of 60 for both men and women would be regarded as a long-term objective. Such may be considered by some today as an outmoded view of 24 years ago. But would this merely suggest that views being put forward now may be similarly regarded 24 years hence? And what is 24 years? That is only 50% of the time of the theoretical projections put forward by the opener this evening, as I understood her. And can the adoption of a specified state pension age in our diversified population be reconcilable? For example, can those who have spent all their working lives in heavy manual work reasonably and justifiably that a lower state pension age should apply to them than to those who have spent their working lives in physically easier sedentary occupations? Thus, there are problems. Nevertheless, a decision needs to be arrived at. May I suggest that if the decision is arrived at, that state pension age is to remain, at least for the time being, at 65 for both sexes, then the right to work, to continue to work, should be respected by all, and the financial terms for reasonable deferment when so chosen by individuals, should be improved significantly. I am reminded of some remarks by the eminent Canadian actuary, H.R. Lawson, reproduced in the Transactions of the 17th International Actuarial Congress, Part 4. He said, "Was it necessarily a good thing for everyone to withdraw abruptly from the accustomed pursuits of a lifetime, solely because of reaching some arbitrary age?" And he asked, "Was the removal of all workers from the labour force at a certain age a good thing or a bad thing for society and for the national economy?" Thank you, President.
My name's Stephen Yeo. As Leslie Tusser just reminded us, the notice of the meeting asks, should state pension age be raised, if so, when and by how much? I think this question overlooks an important issue, which is not the when and by how much it should be raised, but how. There's a tension between the need for long-term planning for pensions and the oh-so-short 4 to 5 year cycle of the election process. This tension is made worse by the tendency of politicians of all colours to misrepresent the policies of their political opponents. Thus, whilst we in this hall might see the obvious need for state pension age to rise, and for that to be made clear to the current working generation, whoever is in opposition at the time when such change is announced would see it as a chance to capture votes from sections of the electorate who might be unaffected, but amongst whom fear could easily be spread. As a result, politicians have devised a variety of ways, some stealthy, of implementing the unpopular policy of increasing state pension age, and I've identified four. The original, which for purposes of identification only I term the Tory way, was that enacted in 1995, whereby the pension age for women retiring after 2010 gradually increases from age 60 to 65. No stealth was needed here, because this had the fair wind of sex equality at its back. The current route of choice, which I term the Labour way, is to improve incentives for late retirement. Whilst it is still arguable whether these incentives are sufficient to make late retirement attractive for everyone, it's easy to see how they can be improved yet further so that even more people retire late. This method has the attraction of being effective relatively quickly, but in the means-tested worlds of ours, suffers from the drawback that poor pensioners will tend to draw their benefits early, so that the behavioural change is most prevalent amongst the richest part of the population. The third way, which I term the Lib Dem way, directs resources to providing significant increase in state pension at an advanced age, perhaps 75, lifting pensioners clear of any definition of poverty beyond that age. That too can be implemented relatively quickly. And whilst it might be the intention at the outset to reduce the age at which the poverty-free state pension is paid, one can see how, if this were not done, later retirement would be encouraged. This very attractive policy would also provide significant relief to the beleaguered annuity market, as the first call on small savers' retirement pots would be to top up their income for the short period between their date of actual retirement and the date at which the large state pension kicked in. Finally, there is the Swedish way. There, the significant part of state pension is provided in the form of a notional DC accumulation, which is applied to purchase a lifetime pension using life expectancy estimates provided by an independent committee. So I hope you agree with me that the question of how state pension age should rise is at least as important as when and by how much. For my part, I think there would be considerable merit if an independent Swedish-style group, perhaps analogous to the Bank of England Monetary Policy Committee, were to play a part in this. This would have the effect of taking a sensitive, critical decision out of the adversarial and, in terms of pension reform, ineffective atmosphere of Westminster. Thank you.
My name is Tony Salter. I'd just like to make a few comments about the state first-tier pension. It all started off very badly because when the scheme started in 1948, the pension was in fact paid at a level one-third lower than Beveridge had recommended as being necessary for subsistence. So instead we've had this dreadful history of reliance on means-tested benefits. And we should remind ourselves that even the pensions credit is not a pension, it's poor relief. And in principle, it's no different from housing benefit or council tax benefit. Now, understandably, calls for reform of the first-tier pension have largely centred on adequacy by uprating the pension to a higher proportion of national average earnings. For instance, the NAPF, wishing to restore the incentive for retirement savings, quite rightly, have advocated the pension set at 22% of such earnings, which would have the effect of increasing the pension from its present level of 16% or thereabouts to what it was before the first Thatcher government. Alan Pickering's report for the Adam Smith Institute in 2004 recommended a universal non-means-tested pension of 40% of such earnings. Now, the Pickering proposal is virtually identical to the one put forward in the Social Policy Subcommittee of the Labour Party in 1973. In Barbara Castle's view, and she told me this personally, this was a very socialist scheme. So she opted instead for the earnings-related additional pension. Now, this, I think, was a most retrogressive step for our mixed economy of pension provision, because it imported into the social security system inequalities of income replacement which more naturally belong to the economic market. So if the proposal was significantly increased state basic pension was considered very socialist by Barbara Castle, it seems highly unlikely that it would commend itself to the welfare conservatives of New Labour. Now, I believe that any proposal for a higher rate basic pension will have to be very focused if it's going to succeed. Age Concern have argued for years for a basic pension that would eliminate the need for means-tested help. In their view, there will always be incomplete take-up of means-tested benefits. The government's target is to have 3 million pensioners receiving pension credit by 2006. According to Age Concern, this target still only represents 75% of eligible pensioners, leaving more than 1 million in poverty. So what is poverty? Now, people can be said to be poor when their incomes fall below the threshold of need. But need is a contestable concept. So if we're going to propose that the state basic pension should be paid at a high enough level to eliminate the necessity for means-tested benefits, we have to try to base it on a concept of adequacy, in my view, which is related to an objective measure of some kind of human needs. But needs are not static, so the poverty threshold changes over time, nor are needs entirely material. They include social and psychological needs as well as food and shelter. Perhaps the most practical and useful way to evaluate and measure this relative concept of need would be to have recourse to household budget standards. That is, specified baskets of goods and services, which when priced represent particular living standards. Now, these can be low cost or poverty, below which health is at risk, or modest but adequate, which aims to meet prevailing standards of what's necessary for health, housing costs, efficient living, and participation in community activities. Budget standards regularly updated are useful indicators of human need. Now, these have been used in North America and mainland Europe very extensively over the last 50 or 60 years. They were, after all, pioneered by Seebohm Rowntree in 1901 in his work on poverty in Europe. And they were used by Beveridge to try to set the standards for the benefits in the post-war welfare state. Budget standards, however, in the view of some people, are not easy to work with. But I suspect that the family budget unit, which revived or tried to revive the use of these standards from about 1985, are right when they say, particularly in relation to pensioners, that without such standards, the risks of poverty and financial justice are unacceptably great. Thank you, Mr. President.
I'll now ask the Honorary Secretary to read a written contribution from Professor Gordon Pepper.
I'm becoming increasingly concerned, indeed alarmed, that people have still not understood that national funding of pensions is a very different subject from funding an individual pension scheme. It is a typical example of the difference between macroeconomics and microeconomics. A nation can only fund pensions in two ways. First, it can fund externally by accumulating assets abroad. This means there must be a deficit on the capital account of the balance of payments, which must be matched by a surplus on the current account. The trouble is that the UK has a large deficit on the current account. Second, it can fund internally by building up productive assets, for example, new factories, in the hope that workers will allow pensioners to benefit from the consequent gain in capital productivity as distinct from labour productivity. The trouble here is that the UK's gross capital formation is low. There needs to be a shift from consumption into investment. However, there's a trade-off between consumption and investment. As consumption falls, people increase their saving. Too large a fall in consumption could lead to a danger of recession, in which case industrialists will not build new factories because they have spare capacity in their existing ones. Overall, the problems are economic rather than actuarial. In the real world, there are no insoluble problems because the world carries on. However, solutions to problems which materialise may be very nasty. Within a funded pension scheme, there is a hidden transfer of assets. Contributors buy assets of pensioners. If all pensions are funded and demographic factors favourable, there are more buyers than sellers. If demographic factors are adverse, there are more sellers than buyers, in which case asset prices will tend to fall and pensioners will be disappointed with the level of their pensions, however prudent actuaries are.
Thank you. I had the pleasure of reading that this afternoon in my desk. Ivor Kenner.
Ivor Kenner. I should like to associate myself with previous remarks about the funding of final salary pension schemes and also about the personal pensions disaster of 1989 to 1991, which I fully agree. The trouble about personal pensions or about these other money purchase benefits under any other name is you need assistance, the average person needs advice on homing into what he hopes to get. Now, the advice costs about £150 an hour, and there's nobody really qualified to give it, you know, if they're honest about it. That's the problem, really. So I think these money purchase things, personal pensions, stakeholder pensions, you name it, I think they're an absolute dead loss. Now, I think we've got to take an integrated approach to company pensions and to state pensions. Now, the population seems to be divided into about four categories. There's the undeserving poor,
there's the deserving poor, there's the fat cats, and there's the people who oscillate between the deserving poor and the undeserving poor, depending on what is best for them themselves. Well, the fat cats are quite simple, because the fat cats are sitting here in this room. I mean, I couldn't believe it, you know. I ceased paying a high rate, well, I didn't cease paying high rate tax, but I paid a lot less. And then I wasn't paying AVCs anymore, national insurance contributions anymore, or share options anymore. And then, lo and behold, I'd only been on pension for a short while, and the government insists on giving me another $5,000 a year. Well, I wasn't going to turn it down. Well, that's the fat cats for you. And now we come to the undeserving poor. The undeserving poor are the people who've probably never saved very much, or at least not so anybody can see. They've probably not in a pension scheme. A lot of them are in the black economy, where their employers have been dodging paying national insurance contributions and probably taxes as well. And then when they get to a 65, shall we say, they decide to retire. Well, strictly, of course, they should be had up. But they won't be had up, and those employees should be had up. What's the point of having the people up? You're not going to get any money out of them. So they get the full means-tested benefit. And not only do they get the means-tested benefit, but they get the the housing benefit. That could be worth as much as $5,000 a year. Council tax benefit, another $1,000 a year. Care benefit, shall we say, another $1,000 a year. And if what's promised is going to happen, they'll probably get free local transport as well. So they're really doing quite well out of this, you see. And now we come to the deserving poor, who make up the bulk of the so-called pensioners movement. Now, these are people to whom the state pension counts for something. They're people who would welcome a citizen's pension, you see, because they realise that if they're total, they don't get any supplementation whatsoever if they're getting over $10,000 a year, or if they've got a trivial amount of savings. Well, this is encouraging people to save. It is utterly a ridiculous situation. So I think when Ms. O'Connell there is talking about the citizen's pension of £109 per week, presumably, we want to know whether there's a citizen's housing benefit or a citizen's council tax benefit or a citizen's care benefit. Because these are things that the vast majority of pensioners are extremely annoyed about. They see themselves as always having paid their taxes, national insurance contributions, etc., etc., save their money, and they're not much better off than the person who's been dodging all his life. And they don't like it very much. So I think we've got to look at the package as a whole. Now, how do I mean that? I think that there still is a role for final salary pension schemes, but they have got to be integrated with the whole state benefit package. I don't know quite how much the figure should be. At the GRE, for example, when you get to 65, assume you retired early and you're a long service member, you find that your pension is reduced exactly by the state retirement pension. Well, I should imagine that to be viable, that deductible would have to go up. But nevertheless, it's quite possible for it to go up. The other thing that is also true is supplying benefits to people that don't cost anything. Now, as we say, there's the cost of supplying free transport to people, especially when most transport firms are subsidised at any rate, is not very much. But on the other hand, it looks a pretty good benefit, actually, and it induces people to use the public transport instead of to use other means. So that's another means by which that could be included in the thing that's integrated into the total pensions package, both state and private. Thank you very much.
I've got one other name on my list, which is Michael Ward. Is he here?
Thank you, Mr. President. My name is Mike Ward. I'd like to talk about a couple of issues related to the state pension. I was glad to see in the Institute's response to the Pensions Commission that they supported a significant reduction, or you supported a significant reduction in means testing. I think there are lots of reasons why means testing should be very significantly reduced. I understand that under present government policies, if the pension credit system remains unchanged, as many as two-thirds or even 75% of people, pensioners, could by 2050 be in receipt of pensions credit. That means probably some people in this room might be in receipt of pensions credit. And that seems to me to be an unacceptable and unsustainable extension of means testing. Now, we've heard already about the fact that means testing doesn't get to all its intended recipients. Over 1 million people currently are missing out on benefits to which they should get. And nobody has mentioned so far, I think, the fact that the actual process of claiming means-tested benefits is not an easy one for all the introduction of call centres and helplines. It's still a stressful process for the average elderly person to have to go through, and it's intrusive into their personal affairs. And as Mr. Kenner pointed out, it's extremely unfair on those people who take their responsibilities seriously and save for themselves. They are penalised very significantly by the current system of means testing. So whilst I'm pleased to hear that from Alison that there is a consensus around raising the level of basic state pension, I do wonder whether that consensus extends to the present government, because as I've seen, as I understand it presently, they remain committed to the policy of means testing on the grounds that, and I see this as the only possible justification for it, that it is effective in minimising the resources used. Yes, okay, but it fails to meet all the other objectives. And it isn't sufficient, if you want to get rid of means testing, just to address the level of the state pension. You also have to look at eligibility, which is where we come to the citizen's pension. I was disappointed to see that the Institute appeared to be supporting the retention of the contribution test. We've already heard that women are disadvantaged by the contribution test. It's also the case that not all men have full contribution records and therefore earn the full state pension. So I favour removing the contribution test altogether and replacing it with a residence test. This would be fairer as between the sexes. I found it interesting that the Institute identified one particular group of pensioners that is disadvantaged, and that's the ethnic minority group of pensioners. And whilst a residence test clearly wouldn't help all of them, it would help a certain number, those that had been here for the residence period but not long enough to have a full contribution record. I think that these are serious issues that we ought to be pressing for further debate on. I hope the Institute would reconsider particularly its response on the contribution test and examine that further in the further submission that I understand is going to be made before August. I was going to say something about the various ways of funding it. I'll limit myself to saying that I think a combination of the options is probably going to be the way forward, but it's been covered fully by other people. Thank you very much.
Mr. President, thank you very much. My name is Phil Mullen, and I'm here as a guest, so thank yourself and the Institute for the opportunity to address you today. The President kindly alluded to one of the reasons I got invited, because I wrote a book on the subject, which I'll repeat the title, not as a plug, but to give you an idea where I'm coming from. The book is called The Imaginary Time Bomb, Why Aging is Not a Social Problem, and it's that theme that I'd like to narrowly address. Picking up on just one tiny portion of Alison's, as ever, excellent and sharp exposition of the key issues facing us on this. And it's a very small point. It's the point between probably about slide 6 and 7, where she had articulated the reasons for the consensus which exists around the inadequate pension at £109 and the reasons for that. But before moving into the what's often called the thorny issue of the trade-offs and how we balance those, and Alison threw up that perhaps the debate should focus more on what can we afford. And it's that, what seems like a tiny point, but I think is a very significant question that I think it would be better that we spend more time on. Effectively, what the consequence of what I'm saying is I think perhaps the pension discussion should helpfully refocus from the very valid question of the distribution of wealth to focus on the question of the creation of wealth and how much we can create over the next period. And I think it's a crucial, to follow on from what was just said by Michael, I think it's a crucial political question, this, as to what we can afford, because however much I'm very well informed that Adair Turner has been misinterpreted and misquoted in the press recently, he does, and the Pensions Commission does articulate a view which I think is misplaced, which is that, as he said, or as was attributed to him in the Sunday Times, saying the problem is that there's not enough money. And that sentiment that there's not enough money, there's not enough cash to be able to afford a pension at the level of £109, is a very deep-rooted presumption. I think it's one that's been used by the politicians, as we've already heard that coming out from Blunkett and from the Chancellor, that there is an affordability issue, that there is a money issue as to what we can afford. And I would just ask you to question that. Take the slide, I think it is number 6, which very well shows what is the cost of such a basic first-tier pension. And I'm taking for granted, not and endorsing the idea that logically this is the most important place to start. Everything else will follow on from that in terms of savings rates and in terms of other pension reforms and so on. But having a decent state pension to give clarity, simplicity and a solid foundation. How much is that going to cost? Alison's slide shows that it will cost 2% of GDP, which, when you think about it, immediately sounds like an awful lot of money. 2% of GDP is what, £20-25 billion. It's even for the supposed fat cats, I don't know if there are any here, but apparently there's a lot of fat cats here. £20-25 billion is an awful lot of money. It signs how can we afford it? It signs there isn't the money there. But what I would ask you to think about is what is the time horizon over which that extra cost of 2% is having to be met? We're not talking about something in this government's term or in the next parliament or in the next 3 or 4 years. It's not something that happens overnight, because aging is not an event that will simply descend upon us. It is a process which, in fact, has been going on for a very long time, the last 100 years or so. And British society and all developed societies have been aging at pretty much at the same rate. It is a process which will take effect over 45 years. That's when the 2% will hit in that slide. And I would ask you to think, that is 2% over 45 years really that much of a challenge to us to be able to afford? Because what else will be happening during the course of those 45 years? Now, I'm not a futurologist, but I would just ask you to consider, I think, and others have alluded to this, think back 45 years in history. Think back to 1960. And think the changes that there have been in the world between 1960 and today, and what changes there will be, and I'm not specifying what they are, over the next 45 years. What I am pretty sure about is that unless the world falls apart, productivity will grow at some level between now and 2050. And even if we take very modest levels of productivity growth, say, you know, less than we've had over the last 20 years, say something like 1.5%, 1.7% a year, society will be incredibly more prosperous in 45 years' time. I mean, in rough terms, we see we're talking about doubling the amount of resources that are created every year in 40 years' time compared to today. So it is a much more prosperous society that we are looking at that 2% burden and apparent unaffordable burden. If you consider then, compared to today, we'll all, if everything was equal and everything was evened out, society would be at 200% of living standards as they are today. That's roughly what happens. Every 35, 40 years, living standards are able to double. And we're talking about taking 2% and even add on the costs of health care and the costs of long-term care. Most figures say something like 4 to 5% of GDP is what we're talking about. It's 4 to 5% out of an economy which is double the size that it is today. And it seems to me that it is a very short-sighted and immediate and impressionistic perspective to have to say that things cannot happen, things cannot change in terms of the way society organises itself, that somehow that becomes an unaffordable issue. So I'd conclude by suggesting that we might be better placed, and to endorse that suggestion from Alison, to focus more on the question of affordability, what we can afford. And through that, to refocus some of the pension discussion away from the very valid issue of wealth distribution and how that entitlements accumulate and so on, to the question of wealth creation. I think it has, to conclude, three merits. Firstly, I think if we emphasise the question of affordability and the creation of wealth, I think it hopefully will allow us to break the logjam which we can anticipate from the politicians who say, great idea, NAPF, great idea from the PPI and others, great idea from this consensus, but we can't afford it. We have to be able to nail that ahead and say that we can afford it. Secondly, I think it's logically more important that we focus on this, because the basic point is that the stronger we are as an economy, the more prosperous will we be. The idea that simply because we're getting older, we're necessarily going to become poorer is wrong. As wealth is created, and more and more wealth created, we can become more prosperous over that time. And logically, that's where we should start. The stronger the economy, the better. And the final merit of this is I think it would help, and I think society would help, if we do move away from simply just talking about savings problems and the savings issue, and do focus more on the question of productive investment. Because I think that is something that we have as a society, as individuals, as governments, as institutions, as professions, much more control over. That we could worry much more, to say, to my last sentence, if we could worry much more over whether productivity grows by 1.5% a year over the next 40 years or 2.5% a year, that 1% gap, you all know, by compound growth, is really immeasurably more important for the future of society, for the future of elderly people, for the future of the retired, for the future of all of us, than that 2% of GDP which a decent pension would cost. So let's think about investment, wealth creation, rather than the individual responsibilities to save and the assumption of unaffordability. That's what I would humbly suggest would be a way of taking the discussion forward. Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Right, can I have a quick show of hands of who's... Right, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay, we've got about 15 or 20 minutes. Could I ask you to keep your remarks to about 3 minutes, please? Not again.
My name is Robert Steele. The thought process I'm going to take you through ought to be obvious, but it isn't. The first basic problem starts... starts with the basic problem of the equitable, which wasn't its guaranteed annuity options. It was that the policyholders were led to believe that they were entitled to a benefit the management weren't aware of, i.e. the exact nature of terminal bonus. Now, this is exactly the same problem with mortgage endowments, where policyholders thought the guaranteed sum assured applied to maturity as well as debt. Now, the mortgage endowment problem has resulted in informed opinion believing that security is important and that a death benefit should not be provided unless actually needed. In contrast, The standard pension policy now offered by the industry is as far away from this as you can get. Essentially, the standard pension policy being offered is just a savings pot that must be used to buy a real pension at retirement. It offers no security of value prior to retirement. It does offer a return of fund death benefit, whether you need it or not. If we were to provide a standard pension policy conforming to the same standards now required for mortgage provision, we would offer a policy that specified pension and a choice of death benefits, including none for those who without any dependents. Now, when we had an insurance industry as opposed to a finance industry, we did offer such policies widely. They were called deferred annuities. What killed widespread deferred annuities was the consumer lobby complaining about the lack of return of fund death benefits. The resulting media hype frightened my then employer to consider adding return of fund to all its existing policies. I'm sure I wasn't the only one. The fact that policyholders were getting value for money was ignored by the media hype. Good example is the expert on BBC's Money Box, who, when actually given the point, says, "Well, I think they get lower charges." Now, the features of a deferred annuity, the security side, can be offered with an standard pension policy with, say, a must-have annuity option, i.e. one that fixes the rate of pension to cash, not the better of this and market value, and things like non-profit funds. The less-than-fund death benefits can be provided by survivorship bonuses, similar to those for immediate annuities, already explained in the reinvented annuities paper. Incidentally, that's how you solve the problem of the battle between the people with self-administered personal pensions who want to do away with the age 75 maximum and keep the money, and the Inland Revenue who are afraid that you wave at that and people will use them to get round estate duty and death duties and never take the pension. After the age 75 limit, the administrator keeps the fund on death but adds survivorship bonus instead. But no, the main point that I've come up to here to explain is that if we want people to privately provide security in retirement, we ought to offer them a product that provides them the type of security they want and not the rubbish they've currently got.
Peter Tompkins, and then Adrian Waddingham.
Mr. President, I shall be very quick. I was just spurred to stand up in response to several of our comments recently to strike a note of caution against, I think, three elements that I've heard this evening. The first is the suggestion of compulsory defined contribution pensions, and I think it's something we should be very careful going down the route of the state enforcing on a citizen obligations which he or she might decide differently for themselves. The second is the suggestion of an employer-based compulsion. I don't think people here are probably so naive as to believe that charging 5% to the employer is any different than reducing the employee's salary to 95 and taking the 5 from the employer. Economically, it might be a sleight of hand that lasts 12 or 24 months for a couple of pay rounds until things adjust. But the employment cost is the employment cost, regardless of where you actually impose the tax. And the third was, I'm afraid, in response to our guest here who was just contributing the argument about getting wealthier and therefore, well, it's small, an extra 2% in response to becoming more wealthy. I don't think it is as simple as that. Indeed, if you said that we double our wealth in the next half century or whatever it might be, why don't we take 10 or 15% out of that wealth and do what the state wants with it? I don't think it works like that. I think that the individual citizen deciding how he or she should spend the money that they earn is a far more valuable way of encouraging productivity and encouraging a world where, if we are twice as wealthy, actually, the state doesn't need to increase its participation in the provision of welfare in retirement. And I'd prefer to see that to be the solution that we aim for ultimately.
Adrian Waddingham, I don't want to talk about state benefits because we are now short of time, and I'm actually very comfortable with the direction that Alison O'Connell would take us in. But I would like to say make a brief point about workplace pension schemes. We've not said very much. And consulting actuaries, most of them are involved in workplace pension schemes, and as far as I can tell, are incredibly busy. But they're doing destructive work. They're closing them down and fighting fires, and that is not at all satisfying. Now, we do use the word crisis, and I think crisis is a complaint about something we had and we lost. There used to be peace, there's now war. And it is odd that we perhaps don't look back at history and prepare to learn a lesson. And I don't mean about apportioning blame for what has gone wrong, but why is it that, for me, the pensions crisis is that 20 years ago, before 1985 in particular, it was not difficult to persuade a good employer, and there are many of them, to set up good retirement benefits for their workforce. Now it is impossible. And what do we do? How do we go back? Because there's a crisis, we seem to spend all our time looking for new and different solutions. Some of my best friends are vegetarians. But promoting vegetarianism was not the answer to the foot and mouth crisis. Now, I am not trying to say that we must go back to the 60th final salary scheme. Some reference has been made to that already. But I think we can do rather better than the plain money purchase pension schemes. And it was very sad for me that in the election, when pensions featured, although not enough, very little was said about what can we do to persuade good employers to voluntarily set up a scheme. And I have no doubt that a scheme set up voluntarily will always be better than one that's set up on a compulsory basis. One thing we could do is reinstate a national insurance incentive. I know we get tax incentive, but we know that works because we can go back and see that when that was introduced in 1978 through contracting out, and I accept what Stuart Lyons said about the contracting out may have caused too many of the wrong sort of schemes to be set up, but as an incentive, it worked. Why can we not reconsider that? And there's another sacred cow that we will have to slaughter. Good employers were taken advantage of, and it's not surprising that they're no longer willing to stand up behind good pension schemes. Those good employers were treated very shabbily by successive governments since 1985, and they could not be forgiven for saying, we won't go near a pension scheme. You've moved the goalpost, compulsory pension increases, imposing the full debt. Now, these individually may have seemed okay at the time, but surely history teaches us that it is unreasonable to ask a willing employer to set up a financial commitment and deny him all safety valves. We must allow reasonable changes with regulatory permission, with adequate periods of notice, to benefits to cope with changing circumstances. We ask for no more than the government did itself on the retrospective change to female retirement age, and employers too should have that freedom. It's no coincidence that in the Netherlands, where a scheme of financial difficulty can have a pause and pension increases till it recovers, is a country where defined benefit schemes still thrive. I think the message is that in workplace pension schemes, we shall have to decide whether we want good pensions or guaranteed pensions. I think life was very much better when more than half the workforce had good pensions through workplace-based schemes.
Mr. President, ladies and gentlemen, for those of you who may not know me, I am the Neanderthal chairman of the Pensions Policy Institute, an organisation, by the way, of which I'm immensely proud, who needs to be reminded by its director, Alison O'Connell, at regular intervals, that there are more women in the land than men. But Alison knows very well that I do understand that, but it is important in the world, the modern world of spin, to create the illusion out there that there are not more women than men in the land, in case it is discovered that the reason behind this is that women live longer than men, or the main reason, anyway. And why is that important? Well, I felt it was important for a long time, but my concerns, I think, have been vindicated if one reads the weekend press and the alleged musings of the chairman of the Pensions Commission reported therein, where we hear that, alluding back to a comment made earlier of affordability, that it may be necessary to have different state pension ages for well-off people, and being well-off, interestingly, might be measured by whether one had a university education or not, than for those who are poorer because they die younger. An interesting concept, I suppose, especially when I understand it's government policy that almost everybody should go to university anyway, and therefore may not be that sustainable. But perhaps it would be more appropriate to consider earlier state pension ages for those who smoke. And I suppose, as somebody who ceased smoking 30 years ago, I might just qualify for an earlier state pension age, although one would like to think that with sensible transition arrangements, I might be safe either way. So my Neanderthal approach did have a purpose, which was, in fact, to protect the interests of women from these dangers. But the reality, seriously, is, of course, that to seek to be selective in the important question of state pension age is so fraught with difficulty as to be, I would suggest, completely unworkable. And I'd suggest that we simply move on and consign that remark, which was probably misreported, I should think, to where it belongs. But that brings me to a slightly more serious point, and this has come through in a number of contributions this evening, which is, what is the role, or what should be the role, of the state in retirement provision? And this comes back to some of the questions in Alison's final slide. I would suggest to you that one of the major reasons for the complexity and indeed inadequacy, as is widely believed, of the state pension system which we have is connected with the involvement of the state in earnings-related pension provision, either through compulsion, which we may have in future, or in the past through SERPs and the complexities of contracting out. We shouldn't be surprised, I think, at that, because earnings-related provision does automatically lead to demands from various interest groups for value under a system which, by its essential nature, should be one of redistribution from the rich to the poor. I believe that a state pension system, as a foundation for further provision, should be first and foremost simple and transparent. That is the way to achieve this much-loved modern word, consensus. Political consensus, in my opinion, is a contradiction in terms and will always be undermined by complex systems which allow opportunistic changes to be made without the electorate noticing what has happened. If we really want sustainability and a solid foundation, then it has to be simple, and I would therefore commend to you the role of the state being restricted to a flat rate pension of some kind. I happen to favour citizenship for some of the reasons which have been given, but one which doesn't tinker either by providing or compelling earnings related pension. Therein lies the route to complexity and being here in 20 years' time having the same debates. And finally, Mr. President, I also believe that the final point on Alison's slide, as I remember it, finding ways to make work more attractive in later life for the vast majority of older people, and not for the few privileged ones like some of you here, including myself, who can migrate to non-executive and other, and even, because we're well enough, voluntary things, translating these opportunities through education and training to the wider population, including, incidentally, not paying generous state pensions to those people in public service jobs, which they should not continue doing beyond middle life because of their nature, such as armed forces, farming, and so on, but providing retraining opportunities for a second career for those people would be a far better use long term of state resources to create opportunities that people will want. I believe it's inevitable that the so-called gap will be filled substantially by paid work. What needs to be planned for is an environment where people will wish to take on that paid work as a matter of preference, not as a matter of necessity. Thank you.
Good evening. Chris Lewin. Everyone who is asked to reform a pension scheme knows that you should look at new entrants first and get it right for them. Only when you have done this should you look at existing members. New entrants have no political baggage, no existing entitlements. I want to concentrate, therefore, on new entrants to the state system. For example, my son, aged 17. What should we promise him as a state pension? We don't know what the state will be able to afford in future years, sheer guesswork. Our promise should therefore be modest. It can always be improved later if the state's resources permit. A modest promise of a very simple nature would easily be understood and encourage personal saving for those who don't think it's going to be enough. In looking at this, what we should provide for someone like this, we need to ask ourselves, what is the purpose of the state pension? And different answers will come according to the answer to that question. I suggest to you that most people would say that the purpose is to provide a reasonable minimum level in the declining years of life, on average, not distinguishing between different groups of people. And in 1948, that was thought to be the last 12 years of life for men. I would suggest to you that's a reasonable measure. And therefore, I think for my son, aged 17, it's quite reasonable to provide him a state pension from age 70. He can retire before that if he wants to save up. Something simple, not linked to expectation of life. And I would say that the citizen pension suggested by the NAPF is a very reasonable measure, 22% of national average earnings, universal, not means tested, would, I think, be quite satisfactory for this purpose as a promise. And then it should be for him and his employer to save on top of this if they wish, knowing that the state has promised no more than the minimum level. I don't think my 17-year-old would object to this, and at the moment, he's going to enter a system which is a mess, which may be a mess for many, many years. Why shouldn't we do something for him now, which is simple like that? Now, that doesn't solve the whole problem, of course. It's a start. For existing members, we can't make such a drastic change. But I do suggest to you that getting it right for new entrants is possible. It doesn't have political disadvantages and can be done quickly and should be. Thank you.
Time for one more quick contribution. Go ahead.
Thanks, Mr. President. Cliff Speed. A state earnings-related pension perpetuates income inequalities during working life. Is that a sensible thing for the state to be doing? I think it brings us back to the idea of the role of the state. It does seem sensible to me that the state should try and have pensioners above the poverty level, although we need to have a good discussion about what we actually mean by that. I applaud the introduction of the pensions credit because it moved a lot of people beyond that, but looking forward, means-tested benefits are untenable if so many people are caught by them. Earnings-related element also, we'll see, will reduce the funds available, resources available, to pay the first-tier pension. That again must call it into question. Effectively, if we have an earnings-related pension, it is a state constraint upon the consumption pattern of an individual. If, as an individual, I want to consume in a different way, this is strictly suboptimal. It doesn't make economic sense. There are, however, very good roles for the state, particularly in promoting efficiency. I'd like to see the state act as an aggregator of services to produce economies of scale. We all know the problems of having very small pots of money to manage, through financial institutions, this can be circumvented. We know that means testing is expensive, but on the other hand, deductions at payroll is extremely efficient. Whatever we build going forward, it needs to be simple, it needs to be efficient, and it needs to be understandable. Thank you.
Thank you, Cliff. I'll now ask Deborah Cooper if she would like to say a few words by way of summary.
It's quite challenging for me to sum up such a diverse range of views over a relatively wide range of topics. And so, using the crystal ball handed out to all actuaries on qualification, I prepared the attached earlier. So this should enable you all to give those of you that are non-actuaries, I suppose, the opportunity to see how well actuaries can anticipate the future. I'm going to start with state provision because that's where this discussion did concentrate mainly. Also, its close relative compulsory saving. And Alison spoke eloquently in favour of reform of the state pension. I think there was a general consensus amongst those people that contributed to the discussion that certainly something had to be done. I have to mention the contributory system because I'm partially responsible for the Institute's submission to the Pensions Commission response, which was mentioned during the debate. So I'd just like to say that the eligibility criteria, I can see lots of strengths to the citizenship principle, but the eligibility criteria under the contributory system has been amended so that some of its previous weaknesses, like the married women's opt-out, for example, have been removed, and it could easily be reformed to remove any remaining problems. Suggesting a citizen's pension will be fairer for all women is, I think, mistaken. It's the level of the basic state pension, rather than the eligibility criteria per se, that makes our current basic state pension seem unfair. There are two points that aren't often raised in this eligibility versus citizenship debate, and the first is who pays. A citizen's pension still has to be contributed for. And who are these women who don't work and can't be credited with contributions due to caring responsibility, for example? They're certainly not women from low-income households. These women enter the employment market, certainly when they can, albeit on low rates of pay. Under a citizen's pension, they would then have to pay taxes to subsidise the not-working partners of the better off. The other point is the political risk that accompanies a citizenship test. Under a contributory system, people accrue rights to a pension, making it difficult for governments to amend state pension retrospectively. There are no accrued rights under a citizen's pension, leaving it vulnerable to the most successful lobbying group's agenda. As the proportion of older people increases, for example, they could choose to vote for the party that promises to pay the biggest pension at the expense of those working taxpayers who must then pay for it. We saw this, although at a much lower scale, in the recent election, as the Labour and Conservative parties vied to give age-related handouts to those over state pension age. There was also some debate over whether the state has any place providing an earnings-related pension, and if so, how it could be afforded. On the grounds of simplicity, particularly if contracting out is permitted, the answer is probably not, given past experience. However, if employers continue replacing defined benefit with defined contribution provision, the state could become the only provider that can actually pay earnings-related benefits. Although it might seem unpopular to say so, there was a lot that was good about the original Castle scheme, particularly the best 20-year rule, for example, which was beneficial to women. And just because it's become the nightmare it is today, we shouldn't dismiss state earnings-related provision without giving it even a cursory glance. Of course, the conclusion might be not to touch a similar design with a barge pole, but at least the debate is worth having. Some people thought that compulsory saving might step in to rescue people from an impoverished retirement. And of course, state pension already provides a form of compulsory retirement saving, and for people on low incomes, if its current value were maintained in real terms, it could serve very well for a large proportion of society. And by current value, I mean assuming S2P currently would be mature. The real issue we face is that the system of compulsory saving we have at the moment is being allowed to wither away because of the way basic state pension and the S2P thresholds are indexed. It seems bizarre to consider bolting yet another system of compulsory saving onto this with a whole new set of rules and regulations when the existing system is already over complex. a real difficulty with extending compulsory saving beyond what's needed to provide for those on low incomes with a reasonable retirement income, so maintaining the status quo, is that it implicitly assumes that there's a single savings regime that will deliver well for everyone. And this just isn't true. Everyone's financial and household circumstances are likely to differ, as well as their employment history and their ability or propensity to bear risk. As a result, whilst compulsory saving could work well for some, it will work badly for others, leaving them less well off whilst of working age, not that much better off in retirement. And of course, the other consequence of such a tax on working people is that it makes it harder for them actually to help themselves. The more heavily each pound of pay is taxed, the harder it is for people on low earnings in particular to improve their financial status. This is the curse of the tax credit. However, what the state does will not be perfect for everyone either. Those of us lucky enough not to be on low incomes whilst of working age will not want to rely on the state for income in retirement. And why should we? I don't think the state should compel me to provide well for my retirement, just as I don't think it should compel me to eat my 5 units of fruit and veg or take 30 minutes exercise every day. In general, it shouldn't be the government's role to protect us from events we can control ourselves, albeit that we might need a little bit of a struggle or help from external agencies. It's there to protect us from events that we can't control. If I wasn't the closing speaker, we could get into an argument that would be essentially political about what events it is that we can control or can't control. But for those of us paid more than the average, I would suggest that saving to provide ourselves with foreign holidays, for example, once in retirement, is something we ought to think of doing for ourselves. Equity release and other forms of saving, remaining longer in work, or phasing retirement are all ways that we can help ourselves to manage this. Provided our basic needs are met, we ought to be allowed flexibility to balance these choices without too much government interference. However, pension saving does fall into a special category because of its long-term nature and complexity, and because the distinction between private saving for retirement and welfare is quite blurred. In this sense, the government does have a role to provide some level of basic income in retirement, and it seems reasonable for pension saving to have a favoured tax status relative to other forms of saving, together with some quite tight restrictions. And I deliberately avoid saying tax relief here, since tax is largely only deferred, and what relief there is actually quite limited. Pension saving is also different because it is generally associated with pay. Moving on then to employer provision, looking at people's patterns of incomes is perhaps obvious, but nonetheless striking how the majority comes from employment whilst of working age, with the bulk after retirement, after pension age, state pension age, likely to come from a variety of sources, largely the state. This pattern makes it clear to me that employers are incredibly well placed to help their employees provide for retirement by providing them with mechanisms for deferring their pay. The evidence is that large employers can do this at low cost, certainly relative to individual provision, although smaller employers may need some support. The question is how to do it in a way that imposes acceptable level of risk to the key parties, the employer and the employee, and the government as a partner in providing social welfare. The way risk is shared between these three groups has changed over the past 10 or 20 years, and at the moment it's clear that it appears unacceptable to just about everyone concerned. It's wrong to suggest that employers and government are the only villains in this scenario. If the status quo in terms of provision had been maintained, then older employees and pensioners would have been the guilty parties, since by retiring earlier or living longer than expected, they've imposed unanticipated costs onto their employers and onto younger taxpayers. Obviously, I don't want to infer that living longer was a cost deliberately imposed on younger generations by a malicious group of elderly pensioners, or that people should be expected to sacrifice themselves just to maintain the original level of risk sharing in the contract. But the balance could have been maintained by reducing the level of benefit provided by schemes or enforcing later retirement. At the time, this flew in the face of received wisdom, contributing to a rather extreme move to define contribution provision, a design, incidentally, that naturally incentivises behaviour that will balance this longevity risk. However, in some cases, as people have commented, replacing final salary with defined contribution schemes has over-adjusted for the shift of risk to employers and placed excessive risk on employees who sometimes can't deal with it very well. Employers, employees, and their representatives need to think of more imaginative approaches to providing deferred pay, which could include some defined contribution provision, perhaps alongside lower-level defined contribution benefits. and tax simplification provisions in the 2004 Finance Act might enable them to do this. The government has optimistically said it would like to achieve a consensus before putting in place further reforms, recognising that retirement planning requires long-term stability. I don't want to appear to throw a wet blanket over their ambitions, but apparently consensus was achieved back in 1975 when the Act introducing SERPs passed through Parliament. Within 10 years, SERPs was already undone, and it was New Labour that served up S2P. I can't remember how many, not very many years ago. And for all its superficially good points, that might prove to be the most futile exercise in state pension reform we ever have to see. This debate is likely to run and run, but an adequate conclusion does need to be reached quickly because people need to feel reasonably confident they know what to expect once they reach retirement. And employers will be reluctant to touch pension provision until there is a conclusion, and unless they feel confident the goalposts aren't going to be moved again in the near and not too distant future. The suggestion that's been referred to for two-tier retirement age is credited to Adair Turner this weekend, but quickly refuted by the government, shows how hard it is even to contribute a new idea to this debate, even if it is indefensible. And it's clear from the contributions to the discussions this evening that consensus could be hard to reach. However, I hope that some acceptable compromise will not be so difficult. There are solutions to this so-called pensions crisis that most groups should be able to agree to, even if only grudgingly, particularly if they enable the other partners in retirement provision to act more appropriately, either on their own or, in the case of employers, on their employees' behalf.
Thank you, Deborah. Well, in view of the fact that I was unable to resist having the first word tonight, and in view of the hour, I think I shall be very self-disciplined and resist the great temptation to have the last word. But I would like to thank everybody who's participated in the discussion here tonight, and I would ask you to join me in thanking in particular our opener and our closer. I think on that note we could at least have some consensus tonight. Those of you who joined in the discussion, if you've got any prepared notes, could you hand them to Pauline or Maria, which will help with the transcript. The next sessional meeting of the Institute will take place on Monday, the 26th of September 2005, when we're intending to have a discussion on the actuarial profession's future strategy following the Morris Review. Before then, we have our annual general meeting on Tuesday, the 28th of June at 5 p.m. here, which will be preceded by a special general meeting at 4:30. After the AGM, we will have a guest speaker, which will be Paul Boyle, Chief Executive of the Financial Reporting Council. And we have, following this meeting now tonight, it only remains for me to invite you to join us for a drink in the council chamber behind, and there I hope we can all continue the discussion on the future of the UK pension system. I now declare the meeting closed.